Thank you for tuning in to the May 7th podcast. I'm Stacey Clardy, the section editor of the Neurology Podcast. This week's featured interview highlights the practice guideline recommendation summary on the treatment of tics in people with Tourette syndrome and chronic tic disorders. In the What's Trending segment, you'll hear part two of a discussion on gene editing, this time focusing on regulation proposals.
Welcome to this week's featured interview. This is Jeff Ratliff from Thomas Jefferson University. This week I'm talking with Dr. Tamara Pringsheim of the University of Calgary. Tamara comes to us from the committee tasked by the AAN's guideline committee to generate a practice guideline for patients with tics and Tourette's. Today we'll be talking about the latest update to these AAN guidelines, which is titled Practice Guideline Recommendation Summary, the Treatment of Tics in People with Tourette Syndrome and Chronic Tic Disorders. The guidelines are comprehensive and discuss recommendations for counseling patients with tics, screening for common comorbidities, management of tics with and without medications, and when to consider surgical interventions. We obviously can't cover the full extent of the guidelines, but we'd like to spend some time discussing some of the larger take-home points. Tamara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So just to jump in, the guideline could be potentially challenging as obviously tic disorders span from childhood into adulthood. And realizing we have listeners who some treat mostly adults and others who treat mostly children, are there important take-home points that you hope our pediatric neurology listeners will take home? And are there other points that maybe the adult neurologists would find more high yield?
So even though there are differences between children and adults with tics, the main principles of assessment and treatment are similar. The first thing you need to ask your patient is whether or not treatment is required. Not all tics need to be treated. There is a need to evaluate if the tics are causing pain, emotional distress, or social impairment. Psychoeducation and watchful waiting may be the only treatment that is required. It's important to remember the natural history of tic disorders when treating children. 75% of children will have an improvement of their tics in late adolescence. So if medications are prescribed, physicians should try periodically to taper and discontinue the medications as they may no longer be needed. Both children and adults with tics need to be assessed for comorbid disorders, as it is often comorbidities that cause more disability than tics. In children, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and generalized anxiety disorder are the most common comorbidities and can have a major impact on social functioning. Anxiety and tics can have a strong reciprocal relationship, and interventions that target anxiety, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, can indirectly improve tics. In adults, it's important to screen for depression and suicidality. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is also common in both children and adults. Most of the evidence we have for the treatment of tics has included both adult and child participants, with the exception of deep brain stimulation. We have good evidence that the comprehensive behavioral intervention for tics is effective in children older than the age of 9, as well as adults.
In the guidelines, you talk a little bit about some of the behavioral or cognitive behavioral interventions for tics, including habit reversal therapy. What can you tell us about HRT? What is it? How should we counsel patients about it?
So the Comprehensive Behavioral Intervention for Tics, also referred to as CBIT, is a behavioral approach for the management of tics, with its primary component consisting of habit reversal therapy. Habit reversal therapy involves the development of tic awareness, which is self-monitoring for tics and the premonitory urges associated with them, as well as competing response training, which is engaging in a voluntary behavior that is physically incompatible with the tic when the urge to perform the tic occurs. It also includes relaxation training and the identification of situational factors that influence tic severity. I tell my patients that it's the closest thing to a cure for tics. The Tourette Association of America has a Find the Provider site where you can find skilled therapists in your area who can provide this treatment.
And certainly there's a place for medication management in tics, which the guidelines cover. Those of us who see patients with tics think about alpha agonists like clonidine or guanfacine or dopamine blocking medications, be they the typical or atypical antipsychotics, as some of the pharmacologic mainstays of our tic management. What are some of the recommendations coming out of the guideline that you could tell us about in terms of how can we select among these medications when we're trying to treat tics that, as you commented at the beginning, are severe enough or bothersome enough to the patient that they do warrant pharmacologic or medication treatment?
I usually advise patients to start with an alpha agonist, as these medications have fewer serious adverse events compared to antipsychotics. With an alpha agonist, of course, you need to watch blood pressure and heart rate, and you can also have problems with sedation, but they're usually well tolerated otherwise. They can also help with symptoms of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which up to 50% of our patients are diagnosed with as well. I use antipsychotics when alpha agonists or other treatments fail. I also do a screening exam for drug-induced movement disorders when the patients are seen in follow-up. I don't prescribe antipsychotics to older adults unless the tics are extremely severe, because the risk of drug-induced movement disorders seems to increase as we age. While we do not have a lot of evidence, botulinum toxin injections are a very well-tolerated treatment in adults with simple motor tics of the face and neck.
The guidelines devote some time discussing cannabis-derived therapies for tics as well, and certainly I have lots of anecdotal evidence from my patients about cannabis products that provide some relief of their tics. What was the review of the literature that you guys did, and what did it teach us about the role of cannabis compounds in tic management as these become increasingly common in our practice?
So with respect to cannabis, there is limited evidence to support the use of THC as a treatment for tics. There's low confidence from one class 2 and one class 3 study in adults that THC is more effective than placebo. We recommend that physicians may consider treatment with cannabis-based medication in treatment-resistant adult patients with clinically relevant tics.
So after going through the literature and coming up with these guidelines, what's next?
So there's a lot of interest right now in non-invasive brain stimulation for tics, including things such as transcranial magnetic stimulation and transcranial direct stimulation. And I know there are a number of ongoing trials in this area. There are ongoing trials of the new dopamine depleters, deutetrabenazine and valbenazine, for tics. So Neurocrine announced in December that their trial of valbenazine for tics failed to meet its primary outcome. There are also ongoing trials of a novel antipsychotic, ecopipam, which is a selective D1 antagonist. There are some other forms of behavioral therapy that are also being explored for tics, including acceptance and commitment therapy, as well as cognitive restructuring around tics.
Perfect. Thank you. So that is probably what we're able to cover about these guidelines, but I do want to recommend to our listeners that they do check out this week's Neurology Journal and look at the full recommendation summary that your committee worked on. I wanted to thank you again for taking the time to join us and educate us a little bit about management of tics and Tourette's.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Jason Crowell with the Neurology Podcast, and this week we are again honored to speak with Pam Bellick about gene editing of human embryos. Pam is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer for the New York Times covering health and science. This interview is a continuation of the conversation we started last week. Pam, once again, thank you for joining us on the podcast to discuss this very important topic.
I'm happy to join you.
Again, briefly, we're discussing the gene editing story from recent months when Dr. He Jinkui, a Chinese scientist, announced to the world last fall that he had successfully edited the genes of two human embryos, and these twins were born in China. The idea of a scientist changing germline cells, so changes that will be passed down to all subsequent generations, has raised a lot of concern in the medical community. Pam has done an outstanding job covering this news for The Times, and last week we reviewed her work from earlier in April regarding the fallout for some of the individuals involved, both for Dr. He, as well as some of his former mentors and collaborators who are here in the United States. Today we're going to talk for a few minutes about the regulatory response to germline gene editing. You can read more about this in Pam's article in the New York Times from March 19th titled World Health Organization Panel Demands a Registry for Human Gene Editing, as well as her piece from January 23rd titled How to Stop Rogue Gene Editing of Human Embryos. So, Pam, what exactly is the World Health Organization calling for, and how might this affect future publication of gene editing research in medical journals?
So the World Health Organization, in response to this, formed a special committee of experts to look at this whole question of human germline editing. And they are really kind of just at the beginning of their process, but they did issue in March a preliminary announcement. And one of the things that they want to do is create an international registry so that anybody who is working on anything in this area would be encouraged, perhaps required, although it's not clear exactly what the enforcement power would be, to register what they are doing so that others could look at it and they would know ahead of time. Similar to a clinical trial registry, but this would be, you know, an international forum that would be specifically devoted to this issue. The other thing that they are looking at is, I guess, as a way to try to enforce or encourage scientists to register, they would try to require both funders and journals that were going to be publishing this work to make that registry a condition of publication or funding. So that's kind of the main recommendation that they have come up with so far. The committee is also, they're going to be meeting over the next several months. I think they think it will take at least a year. And they are likely to come up with other recommendations for when this kind of human genome editing should be applied, what kinds of criteria should be required. There's already some of this that has been issued by an American committee, a National Academy of Sciences committee in 2017, but I think the World Health Organization committee will maybe take this further and also try to kind of codify this so that ideally every country would sign on. And those conditions are likely to be things like you can only do embryo editing to create actual pregnancies, to create actual human babies, if you are addressing a very serious medical condition that cannot be prevented or treated any other way. And they will probably also set some safety guidelines. There are a bunch of kind of safety issues with the editing process that still have not been ironed out. And so they may say, until we get those figured out, can't go ahead. And my guess is that they'll also set ethical approval guidelines that might be more stringent than what is already out there.
Terrific. And that kind of gets at one of the things I was going to ask, which is how can they police this? But I guess you've answered that in the sense that you can regulate it by either kind of restricting the funds that support the research, or you can get at it by regulating the spotlight that is shown on the research in terms of publications. Because obviously, if it was here in the U.S., the National Institutes of Health may just simply say, no, we're not giving you the money to do that. But what I was thinking about is, apart from just withholding research money, is there any other way to kind of prevent it from taking place?
Yeah, I think that, you know, ultimately there is a point where each of these kinds of recommendations from committees like this are going to come down to an honor system, and they are going to come down to what the laws of each individual country require. So the World Health Organization can't say, okay, the law for the world is now this, right? We have national sovereignty. Every country works differently. But laws in the United States, laws in the United Kingdom, much of Europe, do prevent the creation of actual human pregnancies with edited embryos right now. So in a place like China, where the twins experiment took place, the laws are murkier. And I think the hope would be that countries like that would face sort of international peer pressure to strengthen their laws and strengthen their enforcement of existing laws, and that the funnels of funding and publication in peer-reviewed journals would also increase that pressure.
Now, I want to go back to an idea you mentioned a minute ago about placing restrictions on the indications for which gene editing might be used, because this is the ethical question when it comes to this research, right? Which is, where will we draw the line in the sand for use of the technology? Because when I think about gene editing, my mind tends to jump to its use for the more controversial purposes, so enhancement or cosmetic reasons. But I expect that one day this technology, as it's developed and is better understood and proven, it's just not far-fetched to think that we might be using this to treat certain genetic diseases that previously have been without treatment. And so has anyone, either the World Health Organization or any other organization, made comments about the possible benefits of germline gene editing?
Yeah, and that's where the ethical tension comes in. So obviously the ethical fear is what you just expressed, that this will be used for cosmetic, frivolous purposes or to enhance intelligence or in some way enhance human qualities in babies of folks who have the means and the access to this kind of technology. And that would, of course, be unfair and potentially unethical and increase inequality and all of those things. So that is what the international community and the scientific community is trying to prevent by trying to tighten the system. In terms of medical uses, it's interesting because, and there is some disagreement about this in the medical community, about how frequently this could be used for something that actually could not be treated or prevented any other way. If you talk to Dr. Francis Collins at the NIH, his view, as he told me, is that there really are very, very few conditions that you could not prevent with other technologies that we have now, like pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. He's not sure if there is ever going to be a case that he would consider satisfactorily dire enough and with no other means to prevent it, such that embryo editing is the only way to do it. Others feel like they can cite a few examples of cases of conditions where this might be ethically acceptable. But I don't think anybody is really saying that this is going to become, you know, kind of certainly not routine and even widespread. So it does really raise a kind of interesting question of people in the scientific community generally want to support technological progress, and this is clearly an area where, you know, there's a lot of very rapid development, and I think people don't want to kind of put roadblocks in the way of scientific progress. But on the other hand, in terms of application, if a really rigorous criteria is applied to assess the application, you might end up with really very few conditions where this meets all of those tests. And that might be good. That might end up being the situation that we want to be in, right? Where, you know, if you meet this rigorous threshold and we've shown that it's safe, then yes, go ahead. But in other cases, do something else. And there may, in fact, end up, you know, this area is such a rapid and flowering area, there may end up being fewer and fewer conditions where that meets the test, because hopefully we're going to be developing other treatments and other prevention techniques for these genetic conditions down the line.
I think that's why this technology interests me so much, is because ultimately you can imagine that this is going to force us to come down one way or the other on, is this disease, and then is it something that we all agree is adequately or sufficiently treated some other way? Because, you know, there's going to be these criteria, I guess, that we can imagine using to decide what is an acceptable indication for the technology. Let me ask you to speculate here as we wrap up. Where do you see the conversation heading with regards to this gene editing? And specifically, how far out do you think we are? Do you imagine that within, say, the next 5 years, this would be clinically available?
That's very hard to say. I think technologically, 5 years is probably not an unreasonable time frame, assuming that this climate, this post-Chinese twin climate that we're now in, doesn't shut off funding altogether. And I haven't seen indications that it will, but it's hard to say. But this CRISPR-Cas9 editing technique is, as many scientists say, it's relatively easy. It's accessible. It doesn't have to be that expensive. And there are some bugs, so to speak, to iron out in terms of how precise you can be in the editing. And there are clearly evidence that we need to accumulate about how safe it is and what the health consequences might be. But I think that it could be something that is ready within the next 5 to 10 years to be actually used. Whether the ethical climate will permit that in that time frame, I think that might be a more of a question. And I think that's probably good. I mean, most of the responsible thinkers that I've spoken to in this area feel that there really needs to be an open and robust public dialogue about issues like this. It shouldn't just be scientists sitting in a room or ethicists sitting in a room and considering all the angles. They should do that, but they also should open this up in some way for public discussion so that people can air their concerns, so that there isn't misinformation, so that when it is finally deployed in a clinical setting in this limited fashion, that you at least have the public not kind of being surprised about that and having reasonable buy-in to the terms that the ethicists and the scientists are setting. And that's a long process. That could take a long time, depending on how that discussion is held and who supports it and whether our political system is supportive of that kind of discussion. So it's an interesting but open question, I would say.
It's one more reason why I appreciate you taking time to join us to help us think about this and help us kind of look forward to the future and start to consider this issue. Once again, I've been speaking with Pam Bellick of the New York Times. I strongly encourage our audience to read her articles on this topic for more information, especially her article from March 19th titled World Health Organization Panel Demands a Registry for Human Gene Editing, as well as the piece from January 23rd titled How to Stop Rogue Gene Editing of Human Embryos. Pam, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. Happy to do it.
This is Bob Gross. Please check out this week's journal, which features a study on the effect of a gap between new-onset epilepsy diagnosis and treatment in the U.S., and an article on lipid levels and the risk of hemorrhagic stroke among women. Please take a look at these and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.